Welcome to the podcast of Data and Analytics in Business. We will learn from the leading industry experts using data and analytics to solve the problems and create values in practice. We will also learn where the industry is heading to and how data and analytics will shape the industry in the future. Most importantly, how they are preparing their business for digital transformation and disruption in the future. I'm your host, Jason Tan, and thank you for listening.
Hey guys, thank you for listening to the Analytics Show podcast. I really appreciate your support and feedback on our podcast. So just a quick shout out, this episode is sponsored by us at the Analytics Show podcast. So whenever you are listening, follow the link in the description to join our second giveaway, but also the first giveaway of 2022 to win 1 million Shiba Inu, guys. So I want to give away 1 million Shiba Inu, guys. And so no matter what price it will be, you can guarantee to get a million Shiba Inu coin. So start off the year right by standing a chance to win a million of the most promising cryptocurrency of 2022 as a small token of our appreciation for your support. It is a new year and a perfect time to start whatever your new plan for your analytic career. So hop over to the Shiba Inu tribe before it raises up to the cryptocurrency mountain while listening to the podcast. Thank you so much. Bye now. Good afternoon, Neil. Welcome to the Analytics Show podcast. So excited to have you here and also have you as the recording for the end of the year, but to be one of the very first few episodes to start in the year 2022. I'm excited to speak to you here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me here. I'm delighted to be on your podcast, Jason.
Now I'm going to start this live. I know you are arriving from the UK to Australia and you have started multiple successful businesses. My question for you is, among all, what is your favorite business venture so far?
Well, that's absolutely correct. I am an immigrant to Australia and I certainly wasn't born here. I suppose the most proudest and successful is the larger of the businesses that I now hold, which is the GWI Group, and that's GWI and that's GWI Digital, which are Australia-wide. And the reason being is they were started off a kitchen table. In fact, in the headquarters office in Brisbane, up on the wall is still a piece of the original kitchen table where we ate family meals, where we changed nappies on, where the kids did their homework. And it allows everybody to keep a little bit humble. And I'm quite proud of where that is today.
Australia is an immigrant country. I myself is an immigrant. So I always like to get that perspective from different immigrants. Now, my next question on the similar topic is that for the new immigrant who want to start their own business, what advice would you share with them when building a new business in Australia?
This is a really good question, and it's a really simple answer. Ignore all the local advice. And that might sound a little bit terrible, but I certainly found that everybody just wanted to do things just the way they are. And so I would say to anybody who is new, who is looking and can see an opportunity, do it. There will be more people saying don't do it than there will be saying do it. Just get on with it. And throw caution to the wind and make it happen. It will be hard work. There will be many barriers in your way, but just do it.
Wonderful. Now let's come back to GWI. Tell us a little bit more about GWI apart from that, the kitchen table. I look forward to see that one day though.
Yes, certainly. So GWI is a business that was born in Brisbane, Queensland, Australia, now services right across Australia and some parts of the fringe of the Asia Pacific as well. And it started life as a specialist in data and information. Now, to point this out though, this was 2007, 2008, when I was knocking on doors and people were saying, why would I care about data? Why is data important? What's this analytics stuff? I'm not interested. And nobody was really in this space. So GWI has grown now and it's got a lot of government clients, got a lot of private sector clients, not-for-profit clients, And it specializes purely in that data and information and the nexus between digital and technologies. Offices around Australia, big team of people. They never let me anywhere near it these days. I'm very, very hands-off, and probably rightly so, because I cause too much trouble.
I'm speaking of the days of knocking on the door back in 2007 or 2008. Do you remember what was it like when you feel like you saw the future and you were knocking on the door, but then there was all these no and no? And what kept you going?
Well, I arrived in Australia in 2006, and I originally had a job inside of a government department, and I could see the amount of money being spent on projects that just probably weren't delivering value. And I was convinced there were better ways of doing it. I'd been very fortunate in what I had seen and experienced in my previous career. And so I kept challenging the ideas, and then I ultimately realized the greatest value I could add was on the outside, not on the inside. And it probably took 2 to 3 years for really to get going. And I just kept saying, there's a better way of doing this, there's a cheaper way, and just kept going back and being very, very consistent. And also being really honest to people. And sometimes people didn't like that. Sometimes they did. Until eventually people started listening. I started employing people who were far smarter than me. And we were able to be given the opportunity to solve some really complex, wicked problems, which I really could get my teeth into.
Do you remember there was a person who was very supportive during this period of time?
Well, that's a really good question. And certainly in the local area, no. I hate to say. The most supportive person was the voice in my head, which makes me sound a little bit mad. But there wasn't a great deal of support. I vividly remember a very good mentor of mine at the time that I'd gotten to know, telling me that unless I was reselling technology or software, I'd never get anywhere. And in fact, some of the people very closest to me really said no and said I was absolutely going nowhere. It was very, very interesting when things started to turn and become different. And now everybody's into data. And now it's, you know, every other person you speak to is an expert in data.
And everyone is also a data-driven organization as well. I think that voice in our head is certainly one of the important ones, especially we need to learn how to regulate that of not taking on so much of the negative voice. I like that. Now, coming back to the GWI, tell us about your role as the group chairman of GWI.
It sounds very fancy, and people might have a view of what that is. In reality, it's just that I caused that much trouble in the office. I'm banned from going in there, and they keep me at arm's length. My value proposition now to the company is to be able to identify the big complex challenges, contact and get in touch with the stakeholders, bring them together, and really get people to reframe a problem. And across both GWI and GWI Digital, the implementation arm, my job is to really help guide the organization and support its growth. I've got wonderful people that I'm in business with. Neil Makepeace, who's the CEO of the GWI Group, Ian Roderick, who's the CEO of GWI Digital, and they're amazing people. And my job is to really help support and empower them to get on and get out of the way. I provide ideas and input, but I know my place. Often I get consulted on things, particularly around some of the big complex issues, but there really are exceptional people though.
From Meet for Mates to CCIQ and now GWI, one thing that I find that appears to stick out in your works is on social communities and public sectors. Has it always been a deliberate choice? Or what drive you to focus on this area?
Look, I think there's a sense of responsibility. I left school when I was 15. I've got a very poor education. I come from a broken home, if you like, very loving parents, but a broken home. I never had opportunities growing up. And I've got, you know, some good opportunities now. And so I always try and do as much as I can to inspire others to help them achieve. And the world is full of complex challenges. And for every time we advance forward, somebody else misses out. And we just have to constantly be aware of that, whether it be race, whether it be gender, whether it be types of businesses, whatever it is, we just got to be conscious of it. I'm not perfect, but I do as much as I can to make sure the barriers I faced are removed out of the way as much as possible. And so if I can help someone else get a leg up and even get a leg further beyond me, I'll do that. Pay it forward is really what I'm about.
I love it. Now, from your experience, what are the major areas of impact that analytics and data can play within the society and communities to advance further?
Data is really important, but it's only important if it's got context. So the content and context. So data can take a lot of emotion out of the really complex issues in society, but it has to be packaged in a way that it tells a story to the relevant community or stakeholder group. On its own, it's kind of meaningless. And I think it's enormously powerful to help us reduce cost and risk in a whole series of areas, whether it be health and human services, whether it be transportation, whether it be in agriculture, whether it be in wider economics. It can actually provide us better and improved ways of doing things at lower cost and lower risk. Now, that's not to say that we should always take data and use it every single time as it says. We should always apply our own leadership and experience to that data, the context. But I think it's enormously important, particularly in healthcare. And I think there is no better example of that what we're seeing now of the current pandemic and our absolute reliance on data.
Can you share a real life example with us?
I can actually, and it's a really simple example on this one.
Yes, please.
This is very relevant. So for your global listeners, where the business is based out of, the headquarters is in a place called Queensland, Australia. That's 2.5 times the size of Texas in the United States. It's a big, big place. And in the regional areas of Queensland, there are 22 local government areas that have got 65,000 people living in them. And these are enormous land masses with not a lot in between. And the local government mayors in those areas are passionate, committed people who really wanted to make sure that their people were following good health advice. All of the data being provided about vaccination rates, infection rates, were all in PDF documents. So I was asked completely pro bono, could I assist and empower those civic leaders to make better decisions? In the space of 24 hours, we took that data, despite there being millions of dollars being spent in this area, we made it into an interactive, usable story for civic leaders to empower their communities to make better decisions, to lower the risk to vulnerable people. And overnight, we were able to increase the protection of members of the community because actually people could understand the data, read and compare what they were doing to another local government area. And lo and behold, we've been able to advance the conversation forward. And that was a very quick, very small, and that's the power of data used well, because we took money out of the equation. We just solved the problem. And the wonderful team in GWI just worked through the night and made it happen.
That is fascinating. Now, the council, government and public policy will always impact our life and how we fare compared to other society. So in your view, in Australian context, how should public sector utilize data analytics to impact our society directly?
Well, That's a really interesting question, and both of us being migrants from different countries here, Australia has an amazing opportunity. It's an amazing country, enormous resources, our natural wealth, our social welfare system. The problem that we have in Australia is we always think throwing large sums of money at things is the solution, whether it be teaching, whether it be frontline healthcare, whether it be infrastructure. And very few times are we honest and target it. So for instance, why don't we look at underperforming schools and ask why they're underperforming and target them directly, openly, and honestly? Why don't we produce healthcare data in real time so that we can work towards helping and assisting rather than holding things back? Public policy and data is really important, but it's got to be used sensibly. What we shouldn't be doing is targeting communities, vulnerable communities, because they're not doing well. I'm not advocating that. I'm saying that we need to use data to target more effectively. And the other thing is, where we're providing resources for people that don't need it, let's not provide that resource. There are so many examples where resources are being provided and people don't want those resources, yet one size always fits all. And we're way beyond that.
I love it. I think it's a complex issue to tackle on. What are the little things that you think we could do to make that happen or to solve that sort of problem?
Well, I can talk about, you know, the things that we all in the data world talk about, single source of truth and nonsense like that. I think we just need to be honest about the way data is being used and the inconsistent legislation for public policy. So for instance, in Australia, it's actually really, really hard to share data and really, really difficult because all the legislation is different. So, and the problems are really, really challenged. So let's take a good example, right? If I have a family that is going into public housing, and I also have a person who's recently released from prison, and they are going into public housing, and they are a threat or a risk, let's say, to children. How do I know how I can share the data that I don't put them next to each other? And how do I do that? I think that is there in the system, but it's not consistent. And it's very hard for, you know, very talented public servants who are talented people to make those really hard decisions. And we need to move politics out of the way and actually think that we could be a better society if we could share data more easily within domestically. In some cases, we actually share data across to the United States, United Kingdom, far easier than we do internally with inside Australia, which is bizarre.
Yeah. I think it seems like sometimes we are integrating the policy to the key, and that seems to be what is preventing us to be a bit more flexible in the world of everything is agile. How do you think public sector can be a little bit more agile without just using the word, but not actually walking the talk?
One of the cheapest things that industry does is throw stones at the public sector. And one of the things I would say is that the public sector's job is incredibly hard.
I agree.
In the end, it's our money, taxpayers' money. Government doesn't have any money of its own.
Correct.
And we would want them to actually be very careful about how that money is spent. So my answer might surprise you. I actually think we need more empathy of our public sector. I actually think we need more willingness to collaborate better with our public sector. I actually think we need more focus on putting skin in the game as industry. And I don't mean that in terms of money. I mean, when we're asked to sit on a task force or a group or something like that, we actually need to lean in, because these problems aren't government problems. They're our problems. And we have a responsibility to assist and enable those challenges So we'll all get better. My big thing is, you know, grow the pie, not the slice, you know, because if we have a socially and economically vibrant economy, we all do well. Just growing my slice doesn't help anybody.
Exactly. It's about extending the pie. Now, further on to this topic, my next question for you is, how can we expect the executive primary, the agency, to work well with the parliament so they can focus on their value and continue to advance on technology, data analytics, or even AI to serve the community?
Well, in Australia, this is really hard. I could look at other countries around the world. We have to remember in Australia, we are an enormous, enormous geographical landmass with very few people in it, in real terms. So our ability to generate revenue because of the workforce, the amount of people, is actually quite low. And most of the workforce is spread around the coast. And so public policymakers, and let's talk about the elected government, do have quite a tough challenge because our climate is so extreme. Our differences in where we're based is so extreme. What is relevant to someone in Charterville, rural Queensland, or Wagga in rural New South Wales is not relevant to someone in Brisbane or Sydney or Newcastle or Ballarat. And whilst that's similar to other countries around the world, the distances are so big and the costs so high. What could be done better? I have to say that some of the things is government has to stop trying to do some of these things. It actually needs to get out of the way. And it actually needs to say, hey, industry, here's our problem. Please solve it. The problem being is there is a desire to do that both by elected officials and public servants, but the politics gets in the way and then no one can agree. And in the end, we all lose and we squander stuff. There are areas where government should be, where there's market failure, and there's areas where government should not be, and we could actually have a far more vibrant economy and far more taxable revenue if we are willing to change the way that government operated. It doesn't help that government is so centered in a government-centric city such as Canberra. It serves a purpose, but actually I think our model of government is a bit of a challenge here in Australia.
Now, it probably sounds like a magic bullet, but would you say smart city are perhaps the final piece to put all of these things together in solving the problem for the society and community where data take charge in them, and obviously with the context to tell the story? My question then is, this smart city and whether public and public sector can create the society that our community can live in and thrive.
Smart cities as a concept is really important in terms of its application. However, it has been ruined, done to death, used and abused, and has delivered very little value in real terms. So I'll paint a real clear picture. We have a smart city plan. Okay, have my rates gone down? Is my bin collected any quicker? Are the barbecues in the park working any better? No. And so if we're going to be smart, there must be a dividend, and that dividend must be a social dividend. Yes. Or it must be a financial dividend. And so if we're going to be smart, let's be really clear about the dividends we provide in society. So if we're going to be smart, say for CCTV, that's not only about keeping people safe, but that's making sure that people who are homeless are better protected, or right across the board. Our problem is we're very quick to go, yeah, we've got a smart city and it's going to deliver all these benefits. It's not. I have been the author of many a smart city plan. I have been involved in many of the big city deals in Australia where they've not gone well and I've had to deal with them at the back end. And I've audited many a smart city project, and the benefits are few and far between because in the end, they're really tech projects that are wrapped up in a new buzzword. A smart city is one that empowers the community to make a better decision. That's it. Doesn't make it make a better decision. It empowers the community. A better place to park, a better decision on environmentals, a better decision in terms of their safety, a better decision in terms of where they live. Unless we are focused on those things, we won't be smart. Now, Adam Beck of the Smart Cities Council in Australia and New Zealand won't thank me for this, but I think it's a really important area that we need to be very self-reflective on the whole concept of what a smart city is delivering. And my final point is, there isn't a mayor or politician that's gone on an election saying, we've got a smart city and won on that. People get voted in on the basic things of the state of the roads, the state of the healthcare, their safety and security. We've got to be more targeted, and there has to be a social and economic dividend if we're delivering smart.
I love your focus on those important and the fundamental needs of the residents, citizens, and people. Often, I suppose, perhaps the smart city feel is because we are looking at the technology and creating that attainable images in our head where there will be flying car or the train that move in the middle of the air. That is the seems to be the definition of the smart city for most people. What do you think is it, we need to change that mindset that while we would want to have those things and perhaps we will have them eventually, but really is that important needs, the fundamental needs that are way, way more important.
We need to remind ourselves the problem we're solving. I always say to people, what's the exam question again? What is it you actually want to solve? So we have to be really clear, right? Smart cities, and let's just stay on this focus, has to be about the use of data to improve the quality of outcomes. And in today's society, it's about doing more with less. So if that's a basic premise of doing more with less, how do I really utilize the resources I've got to? Now, here's the reality, right? Industrial relations issues. You try pushing a major reform for a local government, that's hard, right? And they're really talented people who do that well. You try pushing a major reform for a government, it's really hard. So we need to also be pragmatic that change is incremental. We can't just suddenly blow a whole sector of the workforce out because, you know what, we actually don't need people to sit on mowers and mow grass now. We could do it all automatically. Well, okay, what are you going to do with those skills of those people? How are you going to help them? How are you going to change there? So we actually need to think far more about the overall gain and benefit rather than just we could mow those lawns faster, quicker, better and get data off them. Yeah, we could. We could do it tomorrow. But actually, that doesn't solve the problem because really what you're going to do is you're going to add to the welfare bill, which is going to rise the cost of everything because you're going to make a whole load of people unemployed. Whereas what could you do to help upskill, change, train? That's it. We've got to be more holistic in our approach.
I think data often tell the story, but as you mentioned earlier, context is far more important, and even more important is to how to frame the context with the data in order to use it to push for some of the policy or some of the reform that is harder to change. How would you advise people to acquire the skill set in terms of framing the story using the data and context in order to achieve what they aim to achieve?
Oh, this is really fundamental what you're asking here about how data is used better. So there's a great quote you may have heard before, which is Mark Twain, which is people use statistics as a drunk uses a lamppost for support rather than illumination. We have to stop using data to force people to do things. The data says, so you should do this here. What we need to do is we need to show both the positive, the negative data, and we need to show people a choice, and we need to empower people. We need to offer people alternatives. We need to show better way of doing things. And we actually need to take a few things slower. When we're telling a story with data, we need to be willing to tell the whole picture, not just the picture that we want them to hear, because that's the real danger. Because every time I see data, it's a bit like in a project when someone says, it's 90% complete, Neil. I'm not interested in the 90% complete. I'm actually interested in the 10% that's not. And that's what I want to hear. So when you show me data, I'm instantly looking for the data that's not there, that the data's not accessible, that the data that doesn't there. So I would say that when we are trying to tell a story with data, let's make sure it's a composite story. Let's make sure that it's open and honest. And we're encouraging and empowering people to inform themselves, not to just tell them the version of events that you want them to hear.
Coming back to where we were at, and this is the final question. What is your advice for the local government and private sector around the world who want to build smart city to better serve their communities?
I think you need to be really brave. And the first thing that you need to do is look at the fees and charges. This is a really hard thing. What many people don't realize in, say, in Australia, is that rates, council rates that people pay is only 3% of taxable revenue. Local governments actually have a very small amount of money to make a change. They're reliant in Australia on the next two levels of government, state for grants and federal government. So the very first thing I think we should do is that we should empower our cities and our regions, not just the urban density, and our regions to make better decisions, but we need to hold them accountable. Because part of the problem at the moment is we build a lot of things and we never hold people accountable, or we don't hold organizations accountable. And so I think there has to be a change in the way that we fund it. And the other thing is, I think that we have to be consistent in the way we're using data and interacting. So I did a keynote speech many years ago for a bunch of mayors, about 90 different mayors in this subject. And I basically said, I will give you more of my personal data if you will give me a more personalized service at a lower cost. And there has to be that conversation, because I can give more of my data and get a lower cost, you know, whether it be a ride share or whether it be a pizza or whatever it is. They have to be willing to go on that journey. Now, many of them would, but they're handcuffs around them in terms of legislation. So what I would say is, be brave.
The understanding and the background of that tax revenue collection and how that impact the service and also the decision I make, I think that's a really important one. Funny enough, it sort of like reminded me of this news that I'm reading, where the mayor of Miami is accepting the Bitcoin and is championing the Bitcoin in order to see it as a different form of the revenue collection. Where do you think we are headed on this? I think the idea itself, it sounds great. I can't say that I understand enough about blockchain, crypto, all those sort of things. I think the concept itself is sound, but where do you think we are headed on this?
So this is a really hard question, because it has so many different answers, right?
Exactly.
First of all, if we start to deregulate our money markets so that we lose control of them, we all will lose out. You know, the Reserve Bank, whether it be the Federal Reserve in the United States, the Reserve Bank in the United Kingdom, or whether it be the Reserve Bank of Australia, it's really important that we have those systems that have a monetary system that is the checks and balances in society. Blockchain is crucial to our future. Cryptocurrencies, whatever it may be, are also incredibly important, but we can't and shouldn't lose control of them in society, because there will be great winners and great losers. So they absolutely have a future. And this goes to the point around smart cities and there. The problem is our public policy is so dated. When people talk about disruption, let's take rideshare, and they talk about disruption. actually, it's not really disruptive. Most of us already knew of this or were using it when we were traveling in another country. It's just that public policy is so far out of date. So what I think is really incumbent is that we need to speed up the cycle of public policy so we can act quicker, we can move quicker. And the more dynamic, and government being dynamic can be a little bit oil and water. It's dynamic in some areas. We need to really help and lean in. And that goes to my other point. Let's lean in, right? How can we be more dynamic? It's crucial in all societies that cryptocurrency and blockchain becomes part of a regulated environment. And the longer we sit in navel gaze and don't do that, the more people will lose out and the more people will win on the extreme. So I think they are crucial tools. Blockchain is really important in terms of our ability to have integrity of system, integrity of process. And I think the sooner blockchain is used in some areas of healthcare and in procurement, in particular public sector procurement, the better.
Fascinating. We'll be really looking forward where this thing is heading. My final two questions for you, and I ask these to every single guest of mine. The first one is, what is your most important first principle?
That's a really simple one. And anybody who knows me will know that it's wrapped up in a quote. And it is, if you don't like change, you will like irrelevance even less. And that's a former US military general, General Eric Schoenig. And it was talking about the change in race and the change in focus inside of the US military. And I say that to a lot of leaders, and it's very confrontational because it's right. We should spend less time listening to the people like us and more time listening to our children and that generation, because they're bringing that change through. And we should be willing to change more regularly, more often, because the tempo of change is getting higher. So it's not about fighting the pandemic. It's learning to live with it and finding ways to move forward. We must embrace change constantly.
I love it. What is one book that you have read and thought it would have been better for your younger self to have?
It's a very recent book. Billy Connolly has just put out his autobiography called Windswept and Interesting. And Billy Connolly, iconic comedian and storyteller. That's actually what he really is. And the advice in there about not really caring what other people think, I wish I'd known that 20 years ago. I wish I'd stuck more to my guns in that area and worried less about what others thought. It is just a beautiful book on life in the twilight years that Billy is still around. And it is so inspiring.
I love it. I think I should definitely add that to my list of reading for 2022. Now, thank you so much, Neil Grant. I remember your
last everyone week. Does the same, don't worry.
At least I didn't get it totally wrong. And thank you so much, Neil, for this coming on to the show to share some of your experience in the data analytics. I really love it. I have learned a lot from that.
Wonderful. And thank you so much for the opportunity. Great podcast. Look forward to hearing this and many others.
Thank you.